Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, back from a tussle with a bad enchilada, which unfortunately got the better of me. And today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius, once again joining us. Herman, how are you? How are things without me? Anything burned down? Nothing terrible?
Yeah, well, we did miss your dulcet tones. There's no denying that. I wouldn't be surprised if the analytics show that, you know, just the 18 to 25 female demographic did not tune in beyond the first few seconds where they realized that you were not hosting. But I mean, we'll wait for the data to come out on that. We are data people, so, you know, let me not make jokes about something very serious.
As they say, Herman, big if true. And of course, we're also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm good, and I'm struggling not to respond to what Herman just said, but like...
yeah, probably best not.
Yes, it's surviving.
Yeah, very good. I see Herman is getting some flack from the comment section. Anyway, so let us start with some joy, because unfortunately today we've got a little bit of a heavy episode. I mean, I know a lot of our episodes are heavy, but this one is quite gruesome. And let us start off with our first story today, which is that a active member of the ANC Women's League and an ANC candidate for election has been killed in a hail of bullets inside her Khayelitsha home at the weekend. Name is Pumeza Nomzazi. She was murdered when two unknown suspects allegedly entered her house in Khayelitsha on Sunday and opened fire. The motive is still unknown, but it's believed the suspects have been waiting for her, suggesting that it may have been a hit. However, this is not entirely confirmed yet. She was the ANC candidate for a ward in the area, Ward 98 in Khayelitsha. Apparently her daughter was with her and she managed to escape, I think, without injury, which is very good. But unfortunately, she was killed. So this has, of course, raised many issues. The ANC Women's League is focusing on the sort of gender-based violence, femicide aspect of the whole thing. But once again, I think the issue that this brings up is really what seems to me to be the spread of political violence, which is very possibly what this may have been, to places outside of Mpumalanga and KZN. So throughout, since the 80s and 90s, the center of violence, political violence in South Africa has been around KZN and Mpumalanga, and most of the rest of the country has been at least relatively free from it. But unfortunately, I get the sense that that may be changing. Terence, do you think that that's a reasonable assessment? What's your take on this story?
Well, we need to know exactly why the killing took place. We don't know whether this is politically motivated or not. So, with that caveat. But we know that elections are high stakes games for individual candidates. Remember, this is often the difference between whether you get a kind of middle class life or you are perhaps stuck in unemployment with the lower rungs of the economy. Also, one of the reasons why, particularly in the ANC, you see a lot of churn with councillors. You know, people jockey very intensely, and often there's a lack of continuity. You know, the sense that it's my turn now. And this often, or this all too frequently, manifests itself in violence. I don't see any real reason why this would remain confined to KZN and Mpumalanga. I mean, KZN particularly has a long tradition of violence. But the methodology and the motivation is likely to be the same. And I imagine in the Western Cape, there are concerns that there are fewer winnable seats, fewer opportunities. Certainly, there isn't a deployment into the provincial government to look forward to, or into an office of the metro. So you probably raise the incentives might be that much higher. Of course, you know, this might be entirely apolitical. We don't know. We'll have to wait. You know what any investigations may uncover.
I think you make a really excellent point there. The way that as the sort of patronage network shrinks in a place, and it is shrinking in South Africa. It's shrinking because, of course, the country is running out of money. It's also shrinking because the ANC is running out of electoral support. And in such an environment, there's shall we say, fewer places to eat at the table. Herman, your thoughts?
No, I absolutely agree with that point. The carcass has been picked almost bone dry, so whatever meat is left on it will be fought over viciously by, you know, whatever vultures are around. That does make the ANC very dangerous. This is a point that I raised the other day when we were discussing the murder of Babita Deokaran, a desperate ANC is desperate in several ways, politically, in terms of its electoral prospects, financially. It can either act to protect, you know, people within the ANC can act to protect the interests they already have, or, you know, act aggressively against the interests of others, the position within the patronage network. And this pressure just makes the ANC incredibly dangerous. It's a movement that has normalized a form of lawlessness, that has normalized a form of violence. I mean, for all the criticism one could aim at the DA and the Freedom Front Plus and COPE, disunity within those parties always seemed to be less fatal than disunity within the ruling party and you know, it goes all the way from chairs being thrown to lives being destroyed. It's just this culture of I don't know, just criminalism that is stoked by this creature becoming more and more desperate and its constituent parts joining in that desperation. But I do think what sort of makes this sad is it could be a political assassination. Because she's within the ANC, and the ANC is well known to have these factions or these elements, or it could just be a straight up murder. One of the how many 30 a day? I can't even remember. This country,
more like 60 a day.
So the fact is that whether it's gender based violence, whether it's just straight up good old deadly, fatal, toxic crime, whether it's political violence, we are spoilt for a perverse choice in understanding what cost this woman her life. And whatever cause it was, you can't help but think that somewhere along the line, everything went wrong in this political system, from protecting people to stand for office to actually implementing decisions that would make the police, you know, not a international laughing stock. So it's terribly sad, and my real fear is that it's a portent of things to come, as the trough becomes emptier and emptier, and the people become more desperate to get their fill.
What's quite interesting to me, actually, is that we unfortunately seem, I think, to have lived through the low point of South African political violence, which is, I think, probably in the sort of mid-2000s, which in so many ways was the best year that South Africa's actually ever had on reflection. I remember being told stories of, you know, my family's been involved in politics for a very long time, and stories of people in the United Party and the National Party back in the sort of 40s and 50s actually being engaged in fist fights and attacks on each other and that kind of thing. So unfortunately, I think political violence is pretty baked into South Africa's sort of history and DNA. And it is something that to see it kind of rearing its ugly head again is quite terrifying. Who's that journalist who recently wrote a book about violence in KZN? That's quite interesting. And of course,
Greg Audre or something.
Yeah. And that continues to be the center of political violence in South Africa. Terence, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
You mentioned the UP and the Nats. My grandfather was involved in the Torch Commando. And the memories of him actually, you know, he was a sergeant in World War II and marshalling his little group of guys to go and sort of stand guard over UP meetings. Apparently, he at one stage things were very rough, and he called his guys to order, all snapped to attention, hobnailed boots down this wooden floor. An absolute racket, and the places went silent. He said, "Well, you know, detachment will advance." He said, "All of a sudden, there were people like bolting for the doors. It'd be very aggressive." But you know, that wasn't as bad as it got. Remember, early 1990s, KZN, you know, was in the civil war. I mean, about what? I'm not the exact numbers escape me, but I think around 20,000 casualties. Right. And you know, I remember the news reports from that time. You know, 5-6 people killed a day, not unusual.
Yeah. Terrible times. And we can only hope that we never see their like again. Anyway, let us move on to unfortunately yet another murder story, and this is something that Terence, you kind of wanted to make a point on. So, in Alex in Joburg. A 15-year-old boy allegedly stabbed a fellow grade 8 pupil to death yesterday. He has now been arrested. He arrived at the police station last night, accompanied by his father, where he handed himself over. It's alleged that they had a fight, and the suspect is accused of stabbing another pupil with a sharp object during break time. And he's appearing in court probably as we speak. So, Terence, you wanted to make a point about, I don't know, violence in our schools. I think anyone who's had a brush with South Africa's public school system, particularly outside of the kind of the wealthier suburbs, knows that violence and gangs and drugs and that kind of thing are not particularly uncommon in a lot of South African schools.
Yeah, look, it's part of the base, the overall breakdown of social fabric. I had a friend who taught in Bonteheerville in the 1980s, and he said, yeah, this was basically standard practice. Gangsters used to come into the school campus, you know, during break to go and harass the kids, and that was just, you know, a part of the course. There have been issues with these cell phone videos, you know, showing kids being bullied or assaulted and then shared, because it's a big joke. And, you know, you mentioned outside the welfare areas, but there are instances where some pretty bad things go down there. There was that case about 3 years ago, of a kid in one of the schools in the south of Joburg who literally assaulted his teacher with a broom. You know, this just speaks to me, this kind of advanced social atrophy. We are, I think, fortunate that we haven't, as far as I know, had a sort of American style school shooting, but I wouldn't bet too much on that sort of thing never happening. Or perhaps it won't, because I think a lot of the violence we have, it's kind of explosive rather than predetermined, almost opportunistic. But there, you know, there again, that speaks to a very, very harsh reality. Now, you can imagine trying to study in an environment like that. The odds are stacked very precariously against the young people there, and frankly also against teachers who are trying to discharge their responsibilities professionally.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, it's a point we've made before, and our previous story kind of talks about it as well. So South Africa is indeed a very violent place. And it seems as though that sort of starts fairly early. Herman, your thoughts on this, and your thoughts on maybe what could be done to solve this problem? I mean, a problem like violence in schools is not one that you can get rid of overnight, although you could probably certainly make things a lot better. What are your thoughts?
I'm slightly intrigued by one of the comments saying that the time for principles has passed. It says, in serious feces, we need plans, not ideals. And I wonder how one could get to a plan without principles and ideals. I mean, if you're going to look at the greatest accomplishments in history or the worst, they do begin with ideals and principles. A plan without an ideal or a principle is merely a recipe without ingredients. So if we want to solve a problem and we need plans, then we probably need some principles and ideals. So it's not you don't have plans at the expense of principles or principles at the expense of plans. But I do think this touches on a conversation that we had a few weeks ago here, where we were sort of criticized for, I think it was Terence and myself again, we were criticized for not offering a solution to teen pregnancy as a, you know, this, we were accused of, you know, just engaging in talk. But the thing is that not every ill out there can be solved through a centralized plan or a policy. I agree with Terence, and this is perhaps where my social conservatism, personal social conservatism kicks in, is that I think if you want to solve these sorts of problems, then you have to make the family stronger. The family structure, the breakdown of the family structure was, I think, a massive contributor to at least the violence in the gang areas. And I do think that most research on this shows that stronger familial moral fiber networks are the only thing that can sustainably address these sorts of issues. So then you must look at what decisions can make the family stronger. Does that mean incentivizing families? No. Does that mean giving, you know, marriage tax allowances? I don't think so. I think you seriously have to consider what has been happening over the last century that has been driving families apart. And you can think of things like apartheid. You can think of things that, you know, fatherless children because the dads needed to go to Johannesburg to participate in an economy that would accommodate their skills. And then you have to look at today's social welfare system that essentially just becomes this poverty trap, where rather than the state becoming a hand up, it's become a handout, very, you know, comparable to a drug dealer. So when you look at these problems, you really need to understand the government cannot solve them. It's not up to the government to solve every ill, but there are certain things that the government could stop doing that would empower citizens, empower parents, empower families to raise kids better. Because if you want the state to raise your kids, fair enough, make this the problem of the state. But if you actually want a sustainable solution where the state functions as it should, as a baseline environmental guarantor of the rule of law and things like that, then we need to understand that some other things are going to kick in, and those things might be closer to philosophy and theology rather than politics.
Terence, any closing thoughts before we move on?
Well, you know, I would say that focus on the family as part of the solution is inherently conservative. I think that any system that socializes positively and productively should be encouraged. You know, it's, look at it like this. You know, it's not necessarily a case of having a two parent nuclear family or whatever, but it is about the ability of parents to exercise authority, to be able to provide for their children. You know, the African extended family, you know, functions very well as a socializing mechanism across the across the continent. I think that the big culprit here probably had to do with migrant labor. How you put that together, I have absolutely no idea. I suspect bodies outside the state, NGOs or churches or whatever, is probably where you need to start. But you know, you're talking about a sense, you know, an atrophy of the institutions that's been going on for generations. I think I said this last time we discussed it. Agri Klaster's comment, former editor of the Sowetan, that the biggest tragedy of South Africa is that we used to have strong families, you know, whether the Western, the Asian, or the African type.
That is one of the great tragedies of South Africa, is that we've lost that.
And Nick, might I add a last sentiment just on that, on this discussion, is that sure. If you're going to the good state giveth and the good state taketh away, the more citizenry becomes expectant on the state to solve its problems, and the more power citizenry gives to the state to solve those problems, the greater the consequences if the state fails. And we see that in South Africa.
No, I think that's definitely correct. Anyway, let us move on to some good news. Not really necessarily good news for South Africa, but good news in general. And that is two of our fellow Southern African countries who are at least doing some things right. So we talked a lot about Zambia and their new president recently, and we'll perhaps get a little bit onto them in a minute. But there's some new information coming out now that while Botswana, our neighbor, had definitely a worse economic contraction last year than previously thought at 8.8%, their growth this year is looking very good. It's looking at growing at around 9.7% in 2021, which is a really phenomenal growth rate. Botswana has had really good growth over the last 10 years or so. It's kind of averaged, I think, around 5% GDP growth, which is actually pushed, I believe, its GDP per capita. So basically how much wealth there is per person above South Africa's. And it's a country that, despite being, I think, literally the poorest country in the world in 1960, or at least it was a contender for poorest country in the world, it's managed to kind of drag itself up to possibly the healthiest and best-run country in Africa. Many problems still, of course, but what country doesn't have a lot of problems? Herman, you wanted to talk on this point? Your thoughts?
Yeah, so one of the points of departure for economic progress must be the question of what do you start with when you try to, you know, grow. And poor countries, Africa, we don't have a lot to start with. So the best you can rely on is your skills, your ingenuity, the ability of people to be creative with what little they have, whether it's their time, whether it's their talents. That's essentially the basic point of departure. However, if you are in a country like South Africa that has a lot more than our, you know, third world competitors or peers might have, we have a relatively industrialized economy. No, Kevin, I don't type when I don't talk. That's not true. When you start with an advantage of that nature, and you get outcompeted by countries like Zambia and Botswana with fundamentally more, let's be honest, primitive economies, then you really have to start questioning what on earth are you doing with that which God has given you. Because like South Africa, Botswana has recently rejigged its GDP assumptions. And where they thought they had a contraction of, I think, 7.4% last year, they actually, the new data showed that they have had a contraction of 8.5%. And yet they are looking at almost a 10% growth. South Africa, on the other hand, looking at 2.1, if we're going to be terribly optimistic, or if we're going to be very, very optimistic, 4% this year. So we're not even recovering that which we had lost. And that's in Botswana, taking into account that their economy is more primitive than ours. But the beautiful thing that Zambia has shown us is that where Botswana's recovery is largely based on the popularity of diamond sales coming back and giving Botswana a significant boost, the only thing that President Hichilema now did that turned Zambia from one of the worst performing investor targets for a decade to overnight essentially one of the best in the world is just put forward sensible policy, making appointments of people that actually, you know, could do the job. If you look at the new announced finance minister, Dr. Muso Kotwane, was Minister of Finance 2008 to 2011, if I remember correctly, and oversaw economic growth of 7.6% GDP every year. And if you go look at what President Hichilema said, productivity, value add, fiscal responsibility, the decentralization of economic and fiscal decision making. I just think on policy alone and on one appointment, President Hichilema has changed the trajectory of his country. Now, of course, the challenge is whether he can stick to that, whether he can accomplish on this. But it just shows that if you put the right policies in place, the response could be immense and almost immediate. You don't have to go through this bizarre consensus-seeking circle, whatever, of NEDLAC and President Ramaphosa trying to find a magical social compact somewhere that will rejig the economy and get it to do something. It's really just simple ideas that can change the fortunes in a country. And if Zambia and Botswana can do it, my word, it really should be a sign of the patheticness of our government, that with the ingenuity of South Africans, with the natural beauty, with the natural resources, and with the industrialized economy, we can't even manage to, I don't know, run a bath.
Right. I think another point I just want to make quickly, and Terence, I want your thoughts on what Herman said and this point. Some of our critics will say things like, oh, you know, you're focusing too much on economic growth. You know, what about all this sort of upliftment, social development, stuff like that? But I think one will find a very strong correlation between positive economic growth and positive social outcomes. I mean, I don't think it's unconnected to suggest that South Africa's low murder rate and relatively lower rates of crime in the mid-2000s also tended to coincide with our period of greatest economic prosperity. I really do think that economic growth tends to, unless it's driven entirely by, like, you know, discovery of oil or something like that, tends to uplift pretty much all people in society in a multitude of ways. Terence, your closing remarks.
Yeah, look, as I said in the show before, I spent quite a lot of time in Zambia. I think that There is desperate poverty. I mean, it's a developing country sort of par excellence. I remember the taxi driver who drove me around Lusaka for a few days, showing me pictures of his house. I think it was basically made out of sand. I mean, you know, stuff like that, which is very, very difficult to get your mind around. On the other hand, it's not it never struck me as a dangerous place to be. And, you know, masses and masses of humanity, and, you know, you're the guy who sticks out, and, you know, you've got all these American dollars on you because you're there in business. But, you know, it's not violent, and it's not aggressive. Its big challenge, though, is to move beyond that sort of resource dependence. You know, there's some bad feeling in Zambia, and I think I can kind of understand where it comes from, that they export all their ore, and, you know, there's a massive trading relationship with Switzerland, which then processes their copper and, you know, gets all the value add. But there again, you know, they have wonderful, wonderful scenery. It's a more or less stable environment. A lot of the tourism that went to Zimbabwe should have been captured by Zambia. And you know, it's going to take more than changes in policy. But Herman is absolutely correct. Changes in policy are where you have to begin. In South Africa, we seem determined to change policies in the wrong direction, and then, you know, try and sweep up the mess later. It's not a happy situation.
No, indeed. And it's important that we do talk about these ideas and what is working, because that is ultimately when the conversation changes in South Africa, and when we do change course, either through the fall of this government or through some strange desire for them to suddenly reform. Deciding on what works and what we should do next is going to be very important. And if we don't want to go down the Venezuela route, we're going to have to look at countries that are seeming to turn things around, like Zambia, like Botswana, and take their ideas on board. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. We will be back with you tomorrow for another episode of The Daily Friend. Please support the Institute of Race Relations and thedailyfriend.co.za. Anyway, have a wonderful day, everyone, and we'll see you tomorrow.